example for the world, as John Adams said, of genuine democracy, which is more than a cover story for oligarchy or dictatorship, or what Snowden has called a turnkey tyranny, the idea that from one day to the next, we could be made into a police state. One last quote from Madison, James Madison. He said, to have all judicial, legislative, and executive power in one person, one man, or one body of men is the very definition of tyranny. Well, that we've actually gone pretty far there. And we have a secret court, the FISA court, supposedly reining in NSA here, which has rejected 11 requests out of some 30,000 for secret subpoenas over the years, and which we've just learned consists of judges who are all appointed by one man, Justice Roberts of the Supreme Court, and like Roberts are nearly all Republicans appointed by a Republican president, a mockery of the idea of an independent judiciary. And with the behavior of the leadership in Congress on both parties toward this crazy idea of involving ourselves directly in the Syrian conflict, contrary to what the rest of the public can all see, which is that it would not end with a few cruise missiles, as promised, but would involve us very heavily. They're behaving in violation of their oath of office, which is not an oath to secrecy, and it is not an oath to the president or the Führer, the executive. It is an oath simply to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And these leaders and this president and his predecessor violated that oath and are violating it, and they shouldn't, because the Constitution was right on this point. So let's make them accountable. Thank you.
You're listening to Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, part of the Pacifica Radio Network, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. We have been listening to the legendary Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg speaking recently at the Berkeley City College on the subject of Chelsea Snowden, Edward Manning, and the threat of war by the Obama administration and a compliant Congress. And that concludes this edition of Earthwatch. We thank those of you who have been calling and remind those who enjoyed any part of tonight's broadcast that we are still taking pledges at area code 516-620-3602. And we welcome your comments with an email to Robert Knight, that's RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
And Earthwatch was brought to you live with portions on recording. No, we didn't get Ellsberg into the studio. And he did a break, but I'm going to do one too. This is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. And you see, I thought I had my music welling up dramatically under me, but no, the volume was off. So there we go. There's my howl. And that constitutes a segue. By the way, was Ellsberg fascinating there, talking about the Constitution, proving how much of a true American and patriot he really is? Wow. Good stuff, Robert. Good stuff, Mr. Ellsberg. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf. Thank you. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning is very carefully planned. I'm going to open the mic. You and I are going to talk. And maybe we'll play some stuff. That's the plan. Stay tuned. Oh, yeah. And you're going to pay for it. Once again, good morning. Forgive me for not being, you know, totally prepared with major great things, but this is our fund drive through October 25th. And yeah, I know, not only have you heard it before, but you've heard it way too much. But I'm also willing to bet you've probably heard how much on the edge WBAI is teetering. On the other hand, I hope that you've heard that there's hope for us. It's a struggle. It's a real struggle. Before the, you know, when we'd say we are in trouble, we'd say if we didn't get money, there would be a possibility that sometime things could happen to us. And now the seesaw has teetered in a very different way. For whatever reason, I'm going to discuss the reason at this point. But now it's a question of if we don't do amazing numbers during this fund drive. And we've been doing, by the way, better than average for WBAI, but it's still not quite high enough in order to assure our future. This time, it's if we don't make amazing numbers and prove that this station is going to be self-sustaining and not a burden on Pacifica Radio, which is us and four other stations, and the majority of the power and all that resides in California, in, as a matter of fact, Pacifica, California, that's why we named that, and L.A., then they're going to make drastic changes because we are the single most valuable asset of Pacifica. We're the only station in the network that is at within a commercial frequency, which means... No, not that we could be sold. That rumor was never true. We can't be sold, but we can be leased. Now, last week, I said, that would be the end of us. And this week, I say, oh, maybe that's not true. It might not be the end of everything. It's really a question of who leases us. And I cannot and will not discuss the rumors. But there are some scenarios, not necessarily the likely ones, but some. Pardon me, an enchanted frog in my throat, some scenarios in which that might help assure better survival. But in any event, in any rate, that, by the way, is the thing that you might hear referred to as an LMA, a Least Management Agreement. Our program director, Andrew Phillips, called for transparency, new teeth, during this fundraising drive. And so I'm willing to talk about all that. But I also want to do a show. And that is something else he said that we should do during this fundraising drive is, number one, do your show. Number two, make some money. Now, I'm sorry to say that last week we were pitching, we were begging. I have been pushing the $10 a month option. This is the WBAI buddy option, which is, I think, you know, the best choice for us and for you. And we have a premium for that, by the way. And this is not the ones that you were hearing before midnight, which is about diet. This is not the various ones. And I'm not putting those down. I don't know enough about them to put them down. What we are pitching is WBAI and Pacifica Radio. And so we have Pacifica on a stick. But better than that, we also have a Best of WBAI collection. And some speaker stuff that's been put together by Peter Beauchamp. This is really good stuff. I'm not going to use the other S word, but you can imagine, okay? And the deal is, I mean, you can get them a la carte. You can get the Best of WBAI thumb drive for a pledge of $50, and you can, I think it's $120 or $130 for the 100 speaker collection and Best of Pacifica stuff. But here's the deal. $10 a month, which obviously means $120 a year, but paid in installments. And you get both of these. Yes, that's a $180 value. It's a, hey, just the thumb drive itself is like a, you know, $20, $30 value. Well, 8-gig thumb drive, I make that a $15 value. But it's a really cool thumb drive. And the fun drive for the thumb drive, okay? I'm already pitching too much, but this is so heartfelt. It's, you know, just coming out. So, and this is the thing that I want to push. Also, later on, yeah, there are more listeners now, obviously, at, you know, 1:30 in the morning or 1:41 in the morning in New York time than there are at 2:50 near when I'm going off. Unless, of course, you're in some other place in the world because you're listening over WBAI.org. And by the way, I am really, really pushing for people in other parts of the world to become WBAI members. I know that we have a bona fide international listenership. New teeth. Barcelona. Does anybody get that gag? If you get that gag, call up and we can discuss what that means. the number to call in the air is 212-650-5782, but you got to explain the connection between New Teeth and Barcelona in order to qualify, all right? So if you're from Barcelona, if you're from Australia, I've gotten emails from, well, not from Barcelona, but from many other places. And we've had people calling on Skype from different parts of the world. Become a WBAI member. Become a WBAI buddy. Pledge $10. Ooh, I haven't given you the phone number for that. You don't know it. It's not engraved in your mind yet. It's not in mine. It's an unusual number. It's the last fund drive where we'll be pitching it. It's area code 516-620-3602 and say that you want to become a WBAI buddy. And that you support, by the way, Hour of the Wolf. That you can mention that. That will help this radio show a great deal. Because our programming is drastically changing. And by the way, that's a good thing. It's not a good thing that certain voices are necessarily going away, but we're also going to be bringing in, as I understand it, some magazine programming that will include a lot of those voices. So the format of WBAI is changing because clearly the not the concept of listener-sponsored radio, not the concept of WBAI, but the way it has been broadcasting and just only raising its money like this, in this very manner, by begging you for money and offering things on a stick, carrots on a stick, in order for you to support us, that too must change. But right now, it's the most effective way that we have of getting money. We have to pay $50,000 a month to broadcast out of the Empire State Building. We have to pay rent here at City College for the two rooms that we've got in order to have a broadcast studio. We've got to pay rent for the floor that we've got at 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, which I got to tell you is such a great looking space. And we need the money in order to build a studio there so we can start broadcasting out of there and doing live events out of the ground floor and stuff like that. And we've let go 2/3 of our staff, and there was already a skeleton crew. And they need money, and we don't have the money to pay them. It's a horrible thing. So we need $200,000 in severance pay. Okay? And that's just the ongoing. And then we have to look to the future. So for all those funds that I've just mentioned, I'm asking you for $10 this month. It'll be $10 next month and ongoing after that. But that's an easy kind of a thing. I am subscribing to a music service so that I can get songs for both at home, and I use it to play songs in the air and stuff like that, costs that much. People who are getting streaming video services, they're paying about that much. Not to mention the cable TV, which averages about $80 to $120, depending on the number of services that you're getting. We're asking for $10. We're just like those other services. The difference being that we're optional. We give you the programming for free. We ask that you support it. And we always say now more than ever, but guess what? Hey, now more than ever. $10 a month, become a WBAI buddy by phoning area code 516-620-3602. I promise I won't be pitching long, so do me a favor and make that call now. 516-620-3602. Under our current setup here at City College, we do not actually have a... The call center is not here. The volunteers are not standing by right here. We have a call center that takes your pledges, and then it is this correct? Yeah. And then it sends an email to tell me that somebody has pledged. I'm not sure that the thing that I'm pitching for, the $10 BAI buddy, gets posted to this. This is something I'm going to have to find out. Apparently, there's been a lot of misinformation among the staff here about what, you know, people are saying, hey, you know, I found a number of the pledges in spam. That means we didn't get the money. No, that's not true. We do get the money. It just means that the information to the person in the control room was lost. But it went into four databases before that. Anyway. Let's talk about Hour of the Wolf for a minute. And what it is we're doing. Yeah, I know probably people going, hey, this is like the night before Comic-Con. Aren't you doing that? No, I'm not. I had been, actually, if I were that involved in Comic-Con, I would probably be getting ready for that. If I were going to any con this weekend, I would be going to CapClave in Washington, D.C. And if you're in the D.C. area, by the way, that is the convention that I recommend. Usually it's a very small, very quiet convention and does not have, you know, teeming throngs of people. But this year, their guest of honor is a very fannish person, a person who you could often find at a number of conventions. But when his name is whispered, all of a sudden, for some reason, people come tearing in to meet George R.R. Martin, author of Game of Thrones, person, by the way, who I may point out has been on this program. And I'm not even going there. I have personal dealings this weekend, and so I will be dealing with those family stuff, good stuff, I must say, but stuff that, well, it's stuff. I do have with me a number of recordings, a number of things that we could be playing, that we could be doing. And this is something, in fact, that I did a few weeks ago. I am quite happy to take your calls and say, oh, I'd like to hear that thing that you mentioned. Hold on, let me, there's the thumb drive I've got. Some of these are the same that I mentioned last week. We are going to hear, regardless, shortly, a review of the movie Gravity, which I have not yet seen. I am going to go next Tuesday. I have a date with my partner, Barbara, and with Margot Adler, who created this show and works at NPR, and is author of Out for Blood, about vampires, not to mention Drawing Down the Moon and Heretic's Heart. Margot is, well, an idol. Leave it that way. She's cool. So I'm going to go see it with her. And this is one of the few movies that I'm saying, yeah, IMAX 3D. And it's one of the few movies that is supposed to be heart-stoppingly scary at moments. But because of the concept and realism, I noticed, by the way, comments from a few people, journalists, that this movie is not science fiction, and I took umbrage. And then I thought about it. They're right. It's not science fiction. It takes place on the International Space Station. Well, that exists. The technology isn't a future technology. All of the technology in the movie exists. It's simply a thriller set out in space. Now, yeah, a few years ago, by definition, that would have been science fiction because it would have been the future. But we're in the future. We're there. We made it. Well, see, BAI makes it, but you and I made it. So it's technically speaking not science fiction. I thought that was a very, very interesting premise. And, yeah, I want to bluster and say, yes, it is, but I think I see the journalist's point. This was in The Guardian, by the way. The Guardian has got to be one of the best major press outlets that really get it when it comes to science fiction. I don't know if it's got to do with Doctor Who. Still, again, anybody talking about Barcelona. But anyway, So what we got? I've played this before, but I wouldn't mind playing some of it again, although I may just do so in the future. An interview with Ken Liu, who is just a brilliant, brilliant person. He's a science fiction / fantasy writer of Asian descent, and the interview that I did with him was mostly about translating, the problems in translating stuff into English, Chinese specifically, because the idioms, the concepts are so interesting. I also have a reading of Ken Liu from one of his Oz stories. The Zelazny that I've got with me, The Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth, it's a little too late to play already because it runs an hour and the Gravity review is going to be 5 minutes long. I have an interview and a reading with Kate Elliott. I have a really fun and interesting interview that I did just over a year ago, 13 months ago, with Cory Doctorow and Charlie Strauss over at Tor Books. In fact, I saw the Science Fiction Writers of America annual meet and greet, or mill and swill, as some people call it, was just this past Monday. Saw a lot of people there and were reaching for people. And there's also just the ability to just talk, take your calls, something that I very much enjoy doing, and we can be freeform on that. So if you'd like to call on the air now and chat and give a preference... Oh, no. First, we're going to play the Gravity review. I'm sorry. We're going to do that first. And then, if you'd like to call on the air and chat for a while, the telephone number in the studio is area code 212-650-5782. Again, 212-650-5782. And that'll be in about 5 minutes. No, don't bother calling yet, because I understand if you call and I don't get to the call immediately, it sort of goes away. But you can call. You should call. You will. Please call to pledge. 516-620-3602. I am not aware that last week we raised any money. And, you know, it's not that, you know, if I get that, you know, 3-4 members, that'll have raised a whole $40, which doesn't even cover the cost of the time on which this show is being broadcast, when you add together the rent, the gas for the car to get here, the, you know, and all that. This show has a bigger carbon footprint, as it were, than $40. I, of course, am unpaid. But it does signal to the program director, to Pacifica, to the management, that science fiction fantasy radio is something that you find of value, as it has been since 1972, which is when Hour of the Wolf began. Okay, so our movie reviewer, Dan Persons, currently, I guess, of Ciné Fantastique, CFQ.com. It's very musical. Has a review of Gravity. And we're going to listen to that and then we'll be back.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Here's the moment that defines Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity for me. Sandra Bullock is in the airlock of an abandoned Russian space station. She strips off her spacesuit, down to her underclothes, and exhausted from having just survived a set of perils that would have emotionally decimated most normal human beings, allows herself to briefly slip into a fugue state. For about a minute, Cuarón's floating, agile camera does nothing but observe Bullock's preternaturally taut body as, curled into a fetal position, it rotates in zero G. There's no dramatic point to the moment. There's a practical one, allowing the audience a brief respite after watching what has amounted to 45 minutes of escalating danger. And there's a filmic reason as well. The sheer beauty of the Zero Gravity Ballet, a technical triumph in which humans are seamlessly integrated into environments where it's hard to determine where practical set ends and computer-generated virtual environment begins. That's the way it goes in Gravity. In telling the tale of astronauts Sandra Bullock and George Clooney being marooned in space after shrapnel from an exploding satellite destroys their shuttle, Cuarón lets stunning imagery take the lead. The dialogue clunks when it isn't out and out unintentionally funny. There is a bit of subtext about Bullock's regrets over the loss of her daughter that's supposed to lend some resonance to the ordeal, but you'd be forgiven if you didn't notice it. And the casting seems to have been designed to take full advantage of Bullock's built-in indomitable pertness and Clooney's innate Clooniness. None of that matters. What Cuarón is after here is the pure, visceral, visual experience, and man, does he deliver. This is space adventure like you've never seen before, a quantum leap in visual storytelling. The long-take technique Cuarón employed in such films as Children of Men here finds its ultimate subject matter, the zero gravity of Earth orbit, allowing the director to move his camera in ways unimaginable, circling his subjects as they struggle to survive, seamlessly floating into a spacesuit to capture a disorienting first-person view, then moving back out to once again observe the chaos. Yet it all seems completely organic, the mobile camera never calling attention to itself. The same can be said for the computer-generated environments, the luminous Earth orbit, and the massive, spindly structures of the space stations. I've not been a big proponent of CG, but if the process can generate imagery this ravishing, this believable, you do truly feel like you're watching events taking place in space, I may have to concede the issue. And for all that the dramatics clunk, the adventure doesn't. The film is essentially a 90-minute action sequence, and Cuarón doesn't falter one step. There's been a lot of chatter about whether it's fair to call Gravity science fiction. I say this is about as old-school SF as you can get, taking scientific principles, in this case the perilous physics of space, where momentum can be both your best friend and worst enemy, positing a scenario in which all support systems are violently yanked away, and then speculating on the outcome, choreographing astonishingly elaborate sequences in which humans grapple for survival in the most hostile environment imaginable, riding the razor's edge between salvation and a slow drift into eternity. Argue legitimacy all you want, argue accuracy all you want, and people have. It's stuff that literally has you on the edge of your seat, told in a way that breaks new ground in cinematic storytelling. You need to see it. If you do, baseline, you need to see it in 3D, and ideally, if at all possible, on the largest screen that's within convenient travel distance to you. Go, drink it in, be happy you were there to see film take a significant step to the medium's next level. I'm Dan Persons. Check out more about the world of fantastic film at Cinefantastique Online over at cfqonline.com.
See, I told you he was going to spell it out that way at the very end. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and vibrating. Actually, it vibrates at 99.5 FM and streams at WBAI.org. I'm willing to take phone calls, by the way, on general subjects, but particularly science fiction. And the number to talk on the air is 650-5782. And yes, this morning we will consider requests. Oh, look at that. People are actually phoning in. Let's see if I can master this here. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert. How do you always manage to be first?
It's your phone system.
Yeah.
And this is going to be very quick. I have 101 temperature, so I'm going to take some cough medicine. However, if you're going to play something, I would love to hear the Ken Liu. That was a fascinating interview on translations.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely going to play that again. The question is whether I'll play it this morning. And the problem is it runs 45 minutes.
Oh, I didn't remember. Anyway.
And it's already 2 o'clock. So, yeah. But I may play a portion of it, nevertheless.
Two questions I have. When is the next reading?
November 5th.
So what about the unofficial one that you were thinking?
Not set.
Okay. November 5th, then. Guy Fawkes Night. That's nice.
Yes.
I have one question.
Yes, and we absolutely demand a penny for a guy to get in. It's not free admission. It's okay. A penny for a guy.
That's fair enough. Fair enough. We can always sing Gunpowder Treason and Plot. Anyway, I have a question to ask you. I was in the Time Warner store this morning on my 96th and Broadway, and I got involved in a conversation with a gentleman who said that he had heard that there were some lost Doctor Who episodes that had been discovered in Ethiopia. Do you know anything about this?
Yeah, this is the claim. This is the second claim that has occurred this year. The first one, I think it was South America or something, but this has not yet been confirmed by the BBC that they have examined this and have approved this. But the claim is that, we know that the BBC just recorded over almost all the early episodes of Doctor Who. However, they also sent copies over to other parts of the Commonwealth and the Empire, and they have been searching for places that may have the equivalent of an air check, some places that may have filmed the episodes off of TV when they were. The claim is that there's somewhere, now there's a lot of conflicting information about, was it Ethiopia, was it South Africa, was it this place or that, is it 100 episodes, is it 150, bearing in mind that a full arc is 4 episodes, so we don't know that they have whole stories, and the BBC itself, BBC News is one thing, but I'm not talking about that. The BBC itself has not said that we are in possession of these. I will say one thing. The timing before the 50th anniversary of the first Doctor Who broadcast on November 23rd, 50 years ago, is awfully convenient. On the other hand, that might just make sense, because it could be that they've been making a concerted effort to try to get stuff to sell for what's going to be an international event on that date.
He seemed to more than think that they were pre-Tom Baker. Do you want to speculate?
We're talking only William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton.
So they're the first two?
First two doctors.
My question is, how would all of these have been lost?
BBC destroyed them. Question.
Oh, they destroyed them?
It's very simple, yeah. They were on Kinescope, and they reused the tape.
Okay.
They were doing the BBC has been actively destroying a lot of their shows and music and stuff. Right up to as recently as 10 years ago, there was a guy who was working at the Beeb and saw some skids of tape, holding tape. That turned out to be all the complete sounds of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. Ooh. The people, the geniuses that created, coming out of a musical movement, Musique Concrète, had created the sounds of Doctor Who and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and all that, and they were on a skid waiting to be destroyed.
Briefly, what's a kinescope?
It's sort of like videotape, except it's not. It's the predecessor to videotape.
It's sound?
It's film.
Film. Oh, film. Okay.
It's a predecessor to videotape, okay. So it's like a video.
Oh, all right. Well,
It's not as good quality as videotape, but there are kinescopes that go back as early as the 40s.
Are you going to do a last question? And I really do have to get some cough medicine. Are you actually going to do a special on the 23rd of November for the 50th anniversary?
I don't know what day of the week that is, but I'll certainly be doing something that week.
That would be the closest show would be the 19th or the 26th.
You're assuming that I'll be on Wednesday nights.
Oh.
Program changes are changing.
Oh, that affects that.
I know not where I shall. I know not where nor when I shall be. I know that I will be, but not where or when.
Sounds like an old song. See you on November 5th.
Okay, very good. All righty. I turned down my mic instead of the phone. My telephone number here is 212-620-5782. And good morning. You're on the radio. Oops. And look at that. It's probably the same caller on the other line now. Hello, you're on the air. Hello.
A moment, please.
Okay, certainly. Yes, it gets confusing because we're on delay.
Yeah, no more confusing than it's been for the previous 30 or 40 years.
Yes, indeed. And how are you, Gary?
Not too bad, Jim, yourself.
I'm hanging in there. New teeth.
Maybe we all. I'm not sure I know who that Robert is, and I'm a little disappointed that he's talking about a temperature of 101 Fahrenheit, but I'm somewhat relieved.
Yeah, well, at least it's Fahrenheit, yes. This is a guy who has been calling since Margo was host of the show, Robert Rodriguez, who's a expert on folk music and folk etymology and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And he somehow manages, and you know, for 40 years to be the first caller. No matter how, we currently have 2 phone lines, but when we had, you know, 10 phone lines, and I would take, you know, all the phones are ringing if I'm lucky, and I would choose a number at random, he's always the first caller.
He probably does it even without looking.
He has to do it without looking.
My little reference. The thing about gravity being science fiction.
Yes.
It's a delightful conundrum to roll around with, because you could figure the exact same movie, aside from the fact that technologically they couldn't have, but if the exact same movie had been made 5, 10, 20 years ago, it would doubtlessly have been science fiction. Right now, as they've been saying, as mundanes have been saying since humans landed on the moon, stop doing science fiction because reality has caught up with science fiction, so there's nothing else you can do.
Well, they're, of course, wrong about that.
Yes, I'm thinking, you remember Destination Moon, 1957 or so?
Unfortunately, yes.
Right. But
movie written by Robert Heinlein.
All that. If it had been made after 1969 when we landed on the moon, aside from what we don't like about it, there'd be no question that it would not have been science fiction. It would have been humdrum retread of what we had already done, landed on the moon. And if, notwithstanding done wrong and done tritely and all that, in the same sense, I think, we wish this had been a science fiction movie, but it was made too late.
Bearing in mind that Cuarón started making it 7 years ago.
I didn't know.
He's been spending 7 years on this in order to get the technology in order to make this feasible. Have you seen it yet?
No.
Okay. He was very, very concerned about the idea of properly displaying the concept of space and really giving you the feeling of being out there. Many people have cited this being the most revolutionary looking movie in terms of displaying what a reality of space would be since 2001, A Space Odyssey. It's in Cinerama. It's that experientially amazing. And one of the people who's credited in helping the movie achieve its goals is James Cameron. And he did, you know, whatever one thinks of the storyline of Avatar. As if there were a storyline. worth mentioning. It makes Destination Moon look sophisticated in some ways.
There.
Yeah, but it was nevertheless eye candy. It was just a riveting, wonderful, experiential event.
Let me grab onto that word that you just used, wonderful, because I think what we're looking for, what we need to focus on, is what for 40 or 60 years we have thought to be the essence, the kernel of science fiction, the sense of wonder. And no matter how old the technology gets, no matter how many years pass since 2001 was made, if we can still look at it and appreciate it for the sense of wonder that it inspired in us then, or even people who are young enough to just see it for the first time, and if it gives them that sense of wonder, then it might not technically be science fiction, but it has done what science fiction is supposed to do.
Evoke
the sense of wonder.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. But for the people who love, and as you know, science fiction fans love to nitpick. Yeah, right. I mean, we used to have to listen to Lester Del Rey, whether something was science fiction or fantasy, based on the premise of whether a certain technology could be proven or not.
I'm laughing because when you talked about nitpicking, I was listening to WQXR earlier this evening,
mm-hmm.
and Terrence McKnight, because Verdi was born 200 years ago, so WQXR has been celebrating the anniversary all month, and he just happened to slip, and he said, this is the 200th bicentennial of his birthday.
Oh, yes, exactly. Wow. The 200th bicentennial. He really was remembered, wasn't he?
Yes, indeed. 40,000 years? Come on.
Okay. Now, that's skiffy.
Yeah, so...
That's about as skiffy as you can get.
I double-checked with somebody to make sure that I wasn't remembering, wasn't doing the calculations wrong, and I left a message on their phone system, but... That's to talk about nitpicking.
Yeah, well, you know, what can we say about New York Public Radio, right?
Still.
Here at Pacifica Radio. Not like we're really. Mistake.
You know, it's just not paying attention. You know, people can make that mistake.
Well, I mean, people were talking about, you know, the turn of the century or the new millennium in the year 2000. And they were a year early.
I think so, and you think so.
Well, I mean, factually, mathematically.
You facts with human beings?
Well, yeah, there's that. There's that.
I mean, half of them vote Republican half the time.
Oh, please. Please. Yes, I know. It's a horrible thing. But right now, I'm just grateful for the fact that the Republicans are, you know, putting a poison pill into Republicanism. And so that the Republicans are bailing. It's true. I mean, you know, there are just too many people in there who say, can we become Republicans again and stop drinking this Lipton stuff? You know, well, basically, you know, a small group of extremists have taken over the Republican Party, but they're a very wealthy group of extremists.
Yeah, and they convince enough people. They look out at moderates and they think they're far leftists.
Yeah, absolutely. And what they do with that money is they prevent the moderates or even just plain old conservatives from getting elected if they don't follow the line where things go better with Koch brothers.
Not bad. Did you just make that up on the spot?
I think so, yeah.
Not bad.
I think so.
Bring it back almost to a science fictional...
but getting back to issues of Another Gravity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talking about the nitpicking of it, I would nit that when Cuaron was imagining writing Gravity, it was science fiction. But by the time it got made, it no longer technically qualified. In any event, it's space opera.
Sounds like, sure enough, you haven't seen it. Both, you did say before you're not going to see it until Tuesday, right?
Next Tuesday, yeah. Adler and Barbara and I, yes.
That sounds like fun. I try to avoid you and the rest of the listeners. Somehow I stumbled across, what's his name? The head of the Hayden Planetarium.
Neil...
Right, Degrassi Tyson.
Degrassi Tyson.
Yeah, he had somewhere on the internet.
He's evil, you know. He's evil because of Pluto.
Huh?
Pluto. He was one of the people leading the team to take Pluto out out of the solar system, but from being a planet. He was instrumental to demoting Pluto to a whatever it is.
Oh, Jim! After 40 years, our first quarrel.
Oh, you agree with him?
I think so. I've always thought it was kind of penny ante as planets go. And
well, you know, again, it may not be science fiction, it's fantasy, but I liked it.
I'm with you there on that.
Okay.
So the thing is, it's available on the internet after you see the movie, the stack of tweets that he has carping about the movie back and forth.
And
it concludes with his saying, aside from all this stuff that they got wrong, I did like the movie.
I've read a lot of the commentaries. I've read some bona fide astronauts, people who've been in the ISS, saying what could not be true in there. It had to do with how jetpacks get used and how somebody could successfully, as a person, dock with a space station and things like that. And, okay, so there's a bit of license, obviously. And this is the old story of a director not letting truth get in the way of telling a good story.
I'm on both sides of that, as I think you are also.
Right? I am on both sides of that. I mean, in Argo, for example, here's a better one, Lincoln. Have you seen either of these films?
Nah, I don't think I've seen anything since Saving Private Ryan, but go ahead.
Okay, these are both really good movies. Lincoln, for virtually no reason, and if I ever meet up with Tony Kushner, who wrote the screenplay, I'm going to have to ask him about it. When they're calling the roll of are they going to pass the act, the Emancipation Proclamation, and they're calling state by state, and we keep cutting back and forth to the room, and it's being telegraphed to Lincoln's office, and somebody shouts it out, they say that Connecticut votes nay. Well, apparently, this really bothered today's modern Connecticut senators. They voted yay. They voted for the Emancipation Proclamation. Why was it changed? Because they were trying to build impact. They were trying to build emotion. And it was more important to the cadence of the movie to have a nay vote at that moment in order to give us doubt, even though, you know, 150 years later we know it passed, to make that dramatically true. So they actually stated a falsehood, which really offended a bunch of people in Connecticut.
Understandably.
In the movie Argo, which is all about the non-making of the movie Lord of Light, which is one reason alone to go see it. Although they never mention Roger Zelazny by name, although it was Ray Bradbury and Ray Harryhausen, along with Jack Kirby, who did the work on creating this movie, which was called Argo. And the CIA bought the rights to this movie based on Lord of Light, which wasn't selling, and in order to pretend to go to Iran.
Hang on. Just in case I'm not the only person of the 50,000 listeners who you have here who have not seen Argo, it is, in fact, historically so, and said in the movie Argo, that the fake movie that they were trying to make around 1980 or so did have Harryhausen and Kirby. And
they mention Kirby. They do not mention Harryhausen. The book does. The movie does not.
The book Argo.
The book Argo. The book by Tony Mendez, who is a CIA agent, who's the person who actually went to Iran and ran this, at that time, covert operation. Extracting. He uses a different word, but a word that I have heard more often from CIA people is extracting six people out of Iran.
Extracting rather than rescue or...
No. They used a different... Oh, exfiltrate. Mendez, in his book and in the movie, refers to it as exfiltrating. In other words, they're not trying to infiltrate, get something in. They're trying to covertly get something out.
So
he refers to it as an exfiltration.
That's their own delightful neologism, then?
Well, the man's real. The man's from the CIA. It was his operation. He can call it what he wants.
I'm entitled to make up a word. I made up the job.
That's exactly true. And he really did make up the job. And his first book was called Master of Disguise, because he was just that. And he explains how disguise does not just mean putting on the makeup that John Chambers, who was the other Hollywood person who he worked with, who's played in the movie by John Goodman, who did the masks in Planet of the Apes and invented Spock's ears and all that stuff. And this is the Hollywood makeup guy he was working with for masks. He was not only using that stuff. More importantly, he was using how to become another person. The faking of the passport, the forging of the documents, the knowing, the becoming the character that you are going to be in order to pull off a covert operation. I heartily recommend the book Argo, and which is, of course, vetted by the CIA, so there's a lot in there that we're probably not told. Not only CIA, but State Department, because it's State Department people that were being exfiltrated. And although an earlier OSS term and CIA term was extracted, and that's a word that, for example, John le Carré would use in his novels.
Well, I can see extracted as an ordinary word in English, which unremarkably would apply in those situations.
Yeah, as somebody was behind enemy lines during World War II as a spy and had to be brought to England, they would perform an extraction.
Sure.
That was the term in that era, and later on.
Hmm.
But not the word that Tony Mendez uses.
Is there any difference in the meaning that you can see? I can't offhand, but bear in mind...
There probably is a subtlety to it. But maybe, you know, there probably is from the point of view of the person devising the operation. Which would be Mendez. Who in the, you know, who's a in reality. Now here we go into where the differences are. In reality, Tony Mendez, who performed the exfiltration, came up with the job and did the whole thing, is a Mexican American. He's half Mexican, which Ben Affleck, who plays him in the movie, doesn't look quite that much. That's almost minor. It's understandable that, you know, Affleck was producing and directing the movie and co-wrote the screenplay, so he gets, you know, to make those rules. Somebody else, Antonio, you know, somebody else who could be box office, like Antonio Banderas, may not have been available, whatever. Put that aside. what happens in the end of the movie as the people are being taken out of Iran is, in reality, the plan worked perfectly. They got on a plane and they left. End of story. Although it's a fascinating story. In the movie, the Revolutionary Guard, the people under Khomeini, all of a sudden get a clue that these people are on that plane, and they run in a car, and there's a chase scene with a car running after the plane to try to pull them out. And dramatically, it really works. But it never happened. So here you had two award-nominated, they're both vying for Best Film last year. Argo won over Lincoln. I think that Lincoln... I enjoyed Argo a lot, but I think that Lincoln is the movie that deserved to win, but that's neither here nor there. Very interesting that you had two fact-based movies where the facts are not maintained.
If I were in charge, movies would have footnotes, but you know what? Nobody listens.
Well, you know, they do have footnotes. Get a DVD player, man. Listen to, I mean, that my favorite thing is then watching these and listening to the DVD commentaries during the movies. You turn on the subtitles so you can read the dialogue, and you can barely hear the dialogue in the soundtrack. But what you get are either the people involved in making the movie, or in the case of older movies, cinema historians talking about them. And you're doing your own, you know, mystery science theater kind of thing, listening to these people explain it and talk about it. And so those are footnotes. And it would be really interesting. I don't think Argo is out on DVD yet, but I'm sure that they've probably already recorded whatever extras they have for it. And it would be so much fun if Tony Mendez were one of the people talking about it. He's appeared on TV enough. He's long retired. And to say, well, this didn't really happen. I'll tell you what really happened here. Mm-hmm. Oh, there was another point of offense, by the way, in Argo, that it is said at one point in the movie that I think the Brits and the Aussies wouldn't allow these six people to take refuge, and it wasn't that simple. And also in the end of the movie, they credit the Americans for a lot of stuff that in fact was actually done by the Canadians. And that's corrected in a at the end of the movie. There's text put on the screen saying, you know, the Canadian ambassador did this, that, and the other thing.
That's nice to know that they put in those little data that help out.
Yeah, but it would have been nicer if they'd written it correctly in the movie in the first place.
What do you think, since you point out that they inserted the chase scene factually gratuitously, but dramatically for effect, would it have made a difference dramatically if they had done it right as far as crediting Canadians is concerned?
Well, the Canadian, no, it would not have affected the movie any way at all if they had done it, if they had attributed credit where the credit was due.
Well, why not, except maybe for American jingoism on the part of the producers?
Not really. I don't think it was that. I think it was simply... I wouldn't say carelessness, but it was a movie in which, you know, could jingoism come into it? I think it's more like a home team spirit. It's an American movie made by Americans, which is being vetted by the State Department and the CIA, openly being vetted, because how else could it be made?
Yeah.
This is a bona fide covert operation that really, really happened. They even make the people in the movie look, with the exception of Ben Affleck playing Tony Mendez, the six hostages really look like the people in real life. And Victor Garber, who plays the Canadian ambassador, actually strongly resembles the Canadian ambassador. And so on and so forth. So they were looking for a certain amount of verisimilitude. But I think it also came down to the fact that when all was said and done, it was our guys who wrote it. And, of course, it's, you know, Iran is said to be making their version of the movie from their point of view. They were very, very put out.
One can imagine.
Yeah. But I thoroughly recommend reading Mendez's book, who, by the way, does talk about Ray Bradbury and Ray Harryhausen and Roger Zelazny.
And it's also called Argo.
It is also called, the movie is based on the book Argo.
Okay.
Which is about the screenplay of the movie. Furthermore, there is a woman who I've actually spoken to who is making a movie about how Argo was being made, and apparently Argo was just a vision of some guy whose name I forget is Barry something, a fanish guy, okay? More movie fandom than science fiction fandom, but fanish guy,
sure,
who wanted to build a theme park called Science Fiction Land and largely base it on Zelazny. And he had bought the rights. He had talked to Zelazny and all this. So there is a production company, a small independent production company that is currently funding itself and gearing up to make a movie about the making of the screenplay Argo and the theme park that went along with it. And I'm going to have those people on the air at some point, by the way. I've spoken to them. They're delightful, interesting, serious people. I would say, unlike the person it sounded like who was actually going to make Science Fiction Land. But I don't...
Jim, where are we talking about this putative Science Fiction Land being?
I believe California.
So it would. It's not something that has anything to do with Iran, then?
No.
Okay.
The whole premise was that this movie Argo was being funded and put together and hopefully being sold to Hollywood by this one guy who also had this vision with drawings by Kirby of this theme park. It was all one and the same. And the screenplay was Argo. And this is a real screenplay, although I'm not sure why that isn't being sold, why it isn't being seen. A lot of people get a lot of the facts wrong. They keep saying that the movie was created by or paid for by the CIA. Not true. The script had been bouncing around Hollywood since about 1977 and was picked up by the CIA about 1980.
So what did it have to do with Iran in the first place?
The reason that the CIA created a front office and bought the rights to the movie was because Tony Mendez was going into Iran claiming to look for locations in which to film his movie.
A movie which...
The movie...
Would shot on
which would be
supposedly shot on location in Iran, which really was not supposed to be taking place in Iran at all, but Iran would have substituted adequately for perhaps the California desert or wherever the Argo was supposed to take place itself.
No, Argo is supposed to take place in wherever Lord of Light is set. Argo is Lord of Light. Just retitled. Argo is Lord of Light by Zelazny. It's a screenplay based on Lord of Light. So whatever the name of that planet is, I don't believe Zelazny ever tells us.
So it has nothing to do with California versus Iran.
No, that's right. Other than the theme park. that the guy was going to create. And I'm not sure that I'm right about where the location was. You know, somebody can look up Wikipedia and get that right. And there will be a documentary about all this being made by people in Brooklyn. Where you are right now.
Okay. Not in my house.
Oh, yeah, no, but I believe actually they're not far from Midwood. But hey, Boardwalk Empire is made in Brooklyn, you know? Brooklyn's becoming a major, along with Queens, is becoming a major studio place. But Argo was a real screenplay being shopped around and not being bought. It really, really sounded like, now I haven't seen the screenplay, but a hack job. I think that today Lord of Light could be made as a movie. I think it should be made as a movie. But in those days, the only way I could have imagined it being made effectively would have been by animation. Whereas if you were to turn it over to somebody like Andrew Stanton, who proved his science fiction directing capabilities with John Carter, a movie that everybody despises and I thought was really good, that really, the special effects in John Carter, people don't even talk about them. And what they are, basically, are they're using Pixar special effects in live action. And nobody noticed. It's that effective.
I did not notice, but I remember enjoying it a lot. I didn't think much of the story, but it was a treat to watch.
Yeah, the story is 100 years old, as cleaned up by Michael Chabon. Trying to make it relevant today and taking from about three of the Edgar Rice Burroughs novels. But, I mean, if one reads the book, be grateful they didn't make the book. You know, the movie came out on the 100th anniversary of the book published. You know, and that needs to be borne in mind. And if the costumes were that depicted in the book, well, all the women would be naked. And this being a Disney film, I don't think they were going to allow that. Now, Andrew Stanton's previous movie to John Carter was WALL-E.
With the hyphen E?
Yes, W-A-L hyphen E. WALL-E. And which I think is one of the best science fiction films of the last 25 years.
And I don't remember it very well. Probably it's a stand up.
It's a Pixar film. It came out maybe 6 years ago. And John Carter is this guy's first live action film. But for political reasons, political within Disney in terms of marketing people versus other marketing people, they didn't want to use the original title, which is Princess of Mars, because Disney putting the word princess into a movie is box office poison to boys.
Box office poison what?
To boys.
Why?
They don't like movies with princesses. Huh. It's that simple. The movie Princess and the Frog, which was, I thought, a pretty good film, a pretty good Disney film, got no box office whatsoever, and people attribute it to that word, the P word. If you want to get, you know, young girls into the theater, that word will do, but it will not bring in the boys. A princess? Bleh. So Princess of Mars wouldn't convey what they wanted it to. Now, then why not John Carter of Mars? I don't...
Because people like you and me would think it's a movie version of ER.
Yeah, well, that's what they ended up doing. They just called it John Carter.
My little joke about TV.
Oh, you know, I got it.
Okay.
I'm totally with you on that. And that's what they did. They took out the of Mars. They just called it John Carter, which, yes, it sounded like an episode of ER. It sounded like it should be starring Noah Wiley.
Right.
Who's currently doing some other science fiction series.
Mm-hmm. He was the librarian, right?
Yes.
And that was TBS or TNT?
One of them, yeah. It was Turner. in either event, it was Turner. But and he was quite good when I was still watching Falling Skies, but I've stopped watching it because they went to places that no one should have gone before or after.
It was kind of painful after a while.
Yeah, exactly. But I liked it in the beginning. So the movie John Carter, which is really a very good film, was, you know, notice critically, you go back and read the reviews and you discover the critics did not eviscerate it, except for those who didn't understand the story, which is commonplace, even though the story is as simple as anything by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
How do you mean they didn't understand the story then?
They didn't, you know, they didn't follow what was going on. They didn't get the time shifting and stuff like that. How, you know, the immortality. And believe me, they give a much better science fictional explanation for how John Carter travels to and from Mars than the book does. The book just has John Carter falling asleep in the back of a cave after being chased in there by bloodthirsty Indians. He's a Confederate soldier.
Worked for Mark Twain.
At least there was a conk on the head. In Mark Twain. That's John Carter in Princess of Mars just falls asleep and wakes up on Mars.
Yep.
That's it. And never is there any kind of reason, rhyme or reason, why that occurred. But the in the movie, they do it a little better. But suffice it to say that Disney marketing did the worst hatchet job on promoting a film they ever have done. And they were claiming that John Carter had, you know, was a $200 million write-off. Well, in fact, it's made over $500 million when you add up the DVD sales and the Asian sales and this and that and the other thing, okay? It was a profitable movie. The fact that it lost all that money was an outright lie. It did not anywhere lose near as much movie money as other movies that came out that same year that were awful. It did not lose as much money as the recent Will Smith movie. Was it called After Earth? I haven't seen it. Or Battleship, or a lot of major Lone Ranger, a lot of major $200 million loss drubs. And critically, John Carter was a success. It got good reviews. Either the New York Times, it did not. But the New Yorker and all the other places I usually read did, and got a fairly decent, reasonable Metacritic score, you know, in the 70s or something like that. And when people watch it, they sort of take the special effects for granted, not realizing that they are seeing as many new effects being brought in to movie technology as perhaps were brought in for Star Wars. The difference being that these are seamless. And now Gravity seems to be the new one.
In other words, then, as far as John Carter was concerned, it's simply a matter of Disney's public relations department managing to convince the public that they had
a disaster,
a failure, when they managed to rescue failure out of
heads rolled. The head of certain the head of Disney Films lost his job. The head of the marketing department lost their job. They did not attribute this directly to John Carter, but there were inner, I believe, let me not say for a fact, but I believe, and I'm not the only one having read articles, that there were inner company politics, which, and this company is a huge company. They own ABC, they own Marvel, they own, you know, half of the they own a lot of the entertainment industry out of there. Right. They own the Muppets. They own all kinds of stuff. And some of the stuff they're doing, by the way, is very, very good. And I thought Carter was pretty decent. But what I thought Carter was most importantly, and what impressed me most, was that Andrew Stanton pulled it off. That as a person coming out of Pixar, moving into a live-action genre, he did well. But as a result of the drubbing that John Carter did, his next movie is going to be Finding Nemo 2. He did the original Finding Nemo. I call that a demotion, because I think his next movie should have been something like Lord of Light. Getting back to all that, because...
Yeah.
That's the kind of technology, that's the kind of movie making, and this is why John Carter was an important film. It demonstrated, just as Gravity demonstrates the capability to have a new kind of space drama and immersive experience, John Carter proved the capability of going where only animation had gone before.
To those who would see it.
Yeah. You know, the fact that you had four-armed creatures, that you had Edgar Rice Burroughs fans are going to eviscerate me, but, you know, the fact that you had the Tharks, the little doggy things, the prehistoric thingies running along, and that they're just integrated so perfectly into the film that nobody really questioned it. Nobody stopped and said, not just that this is, you know, they didn't stop and say, well, you look at the quality of that CGI.
Mm-hmm.
Because they weren't thinking about the CGI.
Because it was done so well that it was unremarkable.
Yeah.
That's part of the... As it's been said for a long time, he makes it look easy.
Yeah. And, you know, here, you know, people go to certain movies and they go, wow, you check out those special effects. And they came out of John Carter not even talking about the special effects. They took them for granted.
Mm.
The movie was set where it was supposed to be set. People just accepted that. And that, to me, was a major landmark in movie making for that reason alone. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was overlong, but I think many movies that could be, could lose 20 minutes and be improved, and I think some other movies, like The Golden Compass, would have been improved if they had added 90 minutes. And nothing, by the way, would improve The Hobbit more than losing about 3 hours.
Sounds a little snide to me, but what do I know? I haven't seen it yet.
Well, let's put it this way. By the time all three parts are out, it's a 9-hour movie.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that tells you right there, you know, 9-hour movie out of a, 180-page children's book? You know, and making sure that they bring in all the characters that they had in Lord of the Rings, even though this book takes place 100 years earlier. And characters that should have been in Lord of the Rings that aren't, like Radagast.
Remind me, who's Radagast?
Radagast the Brown is one of the wizards, one of the Valar. He's sort of the nature wizard, played in the movie by Sylvester McCoy. Otherwise known as the Eighth Doctor.
Yeah.
No, the Seventh Doctor. Wait. Paul McGann is the Ninth Doctor. That's right. So he's...
I'm not going to remember those numbers, Jim.
No. Paul McGann was the Eighth Doctor. And John Hurt is the Eighth and a Half Doctor.
This is not going to register.
Well, after November 23rd, we'll know a lot more about the Eighth Doctor. Because it's my prediction that that's what the 50th anniversary Doctor Who episode is going to be about.
Transition, you mean?
I'm sorry?
The transition, you mean?
No, that will be in Christmas.
Okay, so what are you saying November will be about?
Well, it will be about the Eighth and a Half Doctor. Did you see the finale of the current season with Matt Smith?
I can't keep track. There's two. Frankly,
the current, the one that just ended, a few months ago.
Yeah, was that one of the episodes that had Jenna Louise Coleman dying?
Yes, it's the one where she jumps into the Matrix.
Okay,
It actually harkens back a lot to old Hudum, and then they turn around. And they see that coming out of the Matrix, they turn around and Matt Smith says, "No, not you." And this other guy says, "I never wanted to exist. I never wanted to be, what it is that I became." And it focuses on John Hurt, shows us John Hurt. And the outro is, tune in for the next episode on November 23rd, 2013, the 50th anniversary episode of Doctor Who, with Matt Smith as the Doctor and John Hurt as the Doctor.
When was that shown?
March.
March.
I'm guessing. Whenever this current season ended. It was when Jenna Louise Coleman died for the third time.
And that might or might not be one of the things that they're plastering all over the 24-hour, 7 days a week calendar, the BBC America?
Yeah. And then after that, the Christmas special, that will be Matt Smith's final episode, and that will transition into Peter Capaldi.
Uh-huh.
And Peter Capaldi is the 12th Doctor. John Hurt is not the 12th Doctor, nor, and we don't have time to go into all this, the Valyard, which goes back to Trial of a Time Lord and all that. The concept, as far as I can figure out, going deep and into the excavating who fandom is, that Paul McGann, the 8th Doctor, who only had that one poorly written movie, but he was a very good Doctor, at some point turns into the Doctor. There is a Doctor who fought the Time Wars, who ended up destroying Gallifrey and the Daleks.
None of which has been shown, right?
Correct. But I think that's what we're going to see on the 50th anniversary.
The Time Wars?
Yes, that's my prediction. Or at least it'll involve all that. It will be John Hurt will be the Doctor who caused all that, and at the end of that, we'll have regenerated into Christopher Eccleston, who we never see his regeneration, but we know that in the first episode of the new modern Who, with Rose, that he's examining his ears and says, "New ears, or rather large ears, don't you think? He's just regenerated."
This is around 2005, right?
That's 2005. And then it's 1 year later that that he's talking about going to Barcelona, and then he regenerates into David Tennant, who says, new teeth. Anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, Barcelona. Which is why I brought up Barcelona earlier.
Yeah. I was wondering what he was talking about. Sounded somewhat disjointed, but I suppose he was supposed to.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Huh. Okay.
So, guess what? I'm out of time.
My fault.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it. It was fun.
Me too. I hope it's
been too long since I've heard your voice or seen you, for that matter.
And you, I just hope the other 48,998 listeners enjoyed it too.
Yeah, well, if we have that many, that's part of the question. Isn't it? And if we survive is the other question.
Yes, indeed. Let's all 449,998,000 of us make
pledge
a donation.
$10. $10 a month. Become a WBAI buddy, and you call 516-620-3602 to sign up for that. At least one person has done it this show.
That's a good start.
Yeah, it's a start, exactly.
Yep. keep going, people.
Okay, yeah. And do that during Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister that is coming your way in just a few minutes. Gary, great to hear your voice. Call me at home.
Okay.
Okay.
And everybody else, don't call Jim at home, but call 516.
Yeah, exactly. But you know my number, Gary. They don't.
don't bring all that up. But still, everybody got to call.
But everybody can send me an email at jim@ourwolf.com or on Facebook.
Let me keep prompting you.
Okay.
We got to get off soon, right?
Yeah. Well, not only that, but I've already started Steel I Span. You hear them in the background? Did you know that, by the way, that Steel I Span has a new album coming out that they've written based on Terry Pratchett?
Come on.
They've done a Discworld album, I kid you not, Wintersmith.
We should all buy it from WBAI and contribute.
Well, yeah, maybe I'll have to talk to somebody to see if that's possible.
Okay, I'm pushing.
Yeah. I don't know when it's coming out, but I do know that the trailer for it is available on YouTube. Or go to my page on Facebook. It's there, too.
I open. I'll get off the phone. You encourage people to donate to BAI, and we'll see each other next week, Frank.
Very good.
Bye, Nip.
Take care. Bye-bye. Well, this, as you see, I'm putting down... I left Gary on, and didn't take care of me. Oops, and I downed the theme. Well... This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. I believe I am on the air next week from 1:30 till 3 a.m., but it is during the fundraising drive. So anything is possible. But definitely this week, Burn Baby Burn Clapper is in its proper time slot and coming your way in but a minute if I get out of this seat to let Lister get in here. Thank you for listening. Call area code 516-620-3602 and pledge, pledge, pledge.
Call me, but you want me in prison, 'cause I'm and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs dribble when I burn a cymbal. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
with you fussing and you fight. Won't get in no way, so don't bother with it. Don't bother with you fussing and you fighting.
List Alive, WBAI, the show is called Burn Baby Burn, 99.5, yo, Friday is today, your Friday starts today, your Saturday starts today, your entire Burn Baby Burn weekend starts right here, 99.5, List Alive, 10 minutes after the hour, 10 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you know why we're here, right? We're here because we are fundraising and we gotta make some money right about now. The buddy system is what we're about, hard and stiff. Could have never missed a $10 every month. Would make us cuddle up much better right here at 99.5.
Troublesome girl, but they're just afraid of something they don't understand.